Bag huge savings on your painting projects at Menards. From your kitchen and bath to doors and trim, and even your ceilings, Dutch Boy has the perfect choice for your painting projects. Dutch Boy's DuraFighter is a tough paint and primer that provides great scrub resistance and durability. DuraFighter interior paint starts at $27.75 a gallon. Get an additional 15% savings on all Dutch Boy paints when you put it in the bag. See store for complete details.
Save big money at Menards.
Travolting presents The Fraser's Edge, hosted by Jeff Sweeney and Stuart Elmore, covering The Last Time. Enjoy the episode.
Whoa.
Longest
for the last time.
Whoa, for the last time.
That's right, folks. This week we're talking about the... Oh, God, when did this movie come out?
2006.
The 2006. Oh, my God. I destroyed the flow. We're talking about the 2006 Brendan Fraser motion picture, The Last Time. Thank you for listening to our episode last week on Journey to the End of the Night. This week we're talking about a much chiller movie... where nothing crazy happens.
Yeah, it's all a very...
Just a very
straightforward
film.
Very stable movie.
Yes.
It begins very topical and ends very topical. So, like, typical. I mean, this movie has Michael Keaton in it.
Yes, it does.
Is this our first Michael Keaton movie we've ever... gotten to cover?
Yeah, I think it is.
I think he hasn't been in any other Fraser movies or any Travolta movies.
Yeah, he wasn't
movies.
In any Travolta's.
So it was very pleasant to see a Michael Keaton enter the chat.
Yes.
I'm a huge Michael Keaton fan.
I am too. And the Keaton of this all is actually interesting. Because this is kind of in his down period.
It is, because... Everybody talks about Keaton's, like, late 90s, early 2000s.
Yeah, because Keaton, like, you know, he does Batman. And then he kind of bounces around for a little. His 80s is untouched. His 80s is incredible.
Yeah.
His 90s is mostly things that don't do much.
It's like Batman Returns.
Well, Batman Returns is, like, the end of it. And then it's, like, Speechless, Multiplicity. He has a good small role in Jackie Brown. He's like third or fourth lead in all these movies until you get to Jack Frost, which obviously like explodes. And then his early 2000s is fairly dire.
Yeah.
Because it's all these movies that no one's ever heard of.
Right.
Live from Baghdad, Quicksand.
He's in Herbie, Fully Loaded. Chick Hicks in Cars.
Yeah, his biggest movie in the early 2000s is Cars. That kind of says a lot.
That really does.
But Keaton's really, really in the ruts until around like 2010 when he gets the other guys in Toy Story 3. And like he's kind of the standout in both those movies. And that eventually does lead to him getting, you know, Birdman.
All the way in 2014, yeah. Though, 4 years later.
Which is, you know, his big comeback, and then he does Spotlight, The Founder, Spider-Man, yada, yada, yada.
Now he's in everything again.
He is extremely successful again. Everyone loves Michael Keaton again. He's back as Batman again.
He's fucking back as Batman.
He was in Morbius, everyone's favorite movie.
I know you don't watch TV, Jeff.
I've not seen Dope Sick. I know you're about to say that. I heard it's good.
He's so good in Dope Sick, my dude.
Didn't he win an Emmy for it?
Did he win an Emmy for it?
I believe he won an Emmy for it.
Let me look it up. Won two Emmys. One of them was for Outstanding Lead in a Limited or Anthology Series, Michael Keaton.
Yes.
He is so good in Dope Sick, bro. Mm-hmm. Ah! I love Michael Keaton.
Yeah. I love Michael Keaton, too.
Him in Spotlight?
Oh, he's so good. Spotlight's just maybe the best movie ever made.
I agree.
Spotlight's so good.
Spotlight is so fucking rewatchable.
Spotlight's one of the... If you ever want to watch, like, if someone's just like, what's a well-directed movie, just watch Spotlight.
I could do a four-hour video essay on the rewatchability alone on Spotlight.
Yeah,
Why is it so fucking rewatchable?
It's just so well made. It is so well made.
I know what happens. I know what it's about. I know how it ends. Yet I can always start it and pay full attention to it the entire movie.
No, I can watch Spotlight every day.
It's so good.
It got saddled in the year as being like the easy pick for Best Picture when it won. Because, like, what was it up against? It was
The Revenant, I think.
It was
right?
The Revenant. It was 2016 Oscars. It was up against... Oh, it was... The lineup was The Big Short, Bridge of Spies, Brooklyn, Mad Max, The Martian, The Revenant, and Room.
Wow. And, like... What a year!
The big argument was kind of between The Revenant and Mad Max. I remember that. Was like the...
For Best Picture?
For Best Picture. That was like what people were kind of like pitting against each other.
Yeah. I know The Revenant was a big top dog dealer. Well, because, correct me if I'm wrong, 2016 was the Leo year.
Yeah.
And I don't mean like... of course it was. Leo won Best Actor. No, I mean, this was Leo's like next performance after like Django Unchained. This was like the nomination that he had to win.
Yeah.
Because he had like, what, 4 nominations beforehand?
Yeah. But this was the year where like all the technical awards went to Mad Max.
Yes.
And people thought it was building to a sweep.
Yeah.
And then The Revenant won Best Cinematography.
Yes.
And Best Director.
Yes.
And so people were like, oh, The Revenant's about to win. And Leo won Best Actor,
yes.
And, you know, Bridge of Spies had won Supporting Actor, and Room had won Best Actress.
Yeah.
Screenplay went to The Big Short and Spotlight. Like, everyone was like, where's this going?
Wait, screenplay went to...
Adapted went to The Big Short, original went to Spotlight.
Is Spotlight an original?
Yes.
Even though it's based on a real tale?
It is based on real things, but it isn't based on a, like, article.
Oh,
it is an original screenplay about the Boston Globe reporters. It's not based on a book. It's not based on an article they wrote, although it uses that as like reference.
Yeah.
But it's an original screenplay.
That seems a little loosey-goosey, don't you think?
I mean, any like historical drama could
be. Yes, any historical drama could be thought of as an adapted screenplay.
Yeah. Because
I guess that makes sense.
An adaptation is an adaptation of a written work.
Yes.
A specific written work.
Yes. Okay. But then there's a newspaper article.
Which is also the funny reason why sequels are actually all technically adapted screenplays.
Yes.
Because they are adaptations of the original movie.
Yeah.
Like Glass Onion, Knives Out was nominated for Best Original Screenplay. Glass Onion was nominated for Best Adapted Screenplay. Because it is an adaptation of the original movie.
The first one,
yes.
Deserving. Second one, undeserving.
I like Glass Onion. I'm a Glass Onion guy.
I'm not.
He's just so stupid. Oh, it's dumb.
It's brilliant.
No!
It's just dumb.
I like how Knives Out is a movie about old money and Glass Onion is a movie about new money.
Yeah.
And that it is two separate ways of skewering the elite, but one is about, you know, I said just said old money and new money. It's your Elon Musk versus your fucking trying to find a parallel for the Christopher Plummer character, but failing. Whatever.
Warren Buffett.
Yeah, like a Warren Buffett or something.
Yeah.
I mean, he's an author in the book, but it's the same basic idea.
Yeah. But yeah, Spotlight, one of the best fucking movies.
Yeah, it's
the
so good.
Founder is so good.
I've heard the Founder. Do you like The Founder?
I love The Founder. It's slept on. The Founder gets slept on. People sleep on The Founder.
Should I watch The Founder?
You should watch The Founder.
I'll get around to it maybe in like 20 years.
No, you would actually like The Founder.
I'm sure. I am positive.
I think you would love The Founder, actually.
I am positive I would like The Founder.
Yeah. He's got a few random ones out here that I have not seen, like Worth in 2020.
Are we talking about...
Michael Keaton.
Michael Keaton, okay.
He was in Dumbo.
He was in Dumbo. He's good in Dumbo.
American Assassin.
Have you seen Dumbo?
No.
Dumbo is funny because it's basically Tim Burton like getting all his old like collaborators back.
Yeah.
And some of them are very game. Like Michael Keaton's having fun. Danny DeVito is having a good time. Colin Farrell is in it. He's great. But it does hilariously like Alan Arkin he brings back from, you know, Edward Scissorhands. And Alan Arkin maybe gives the most checked out performance I've ever seen in a movie in Dumbo. There's like a part where he's at a circus at the end and the circus like explodes. And Alan Arkin walks in and he's like, oh, this is a disaster. What are you going to do? As like there's like flames and explosions going on behind him. It's so funny.
Yeah.
Dumbo, surprisingly, maybe Tim Burton's best movie of the 2010s.
I think I'm going to watch Dope Sick again just because we talked about it. But we're not here to talk about all of those movies. We're here to talk about his 2006 movie, The Last Time.
Yes.
A
movie that I would describe as kind of not really coherent. Doesn't quite know what it's trying to do.
Well, and thank you for listening to our last episode last week.
I already
on
said that.
Journey to the End of the Night, a movie that is definitely a very cohesive movie.
Yes. So the introduction to this movie... should we talk about Fraser? We should talk about Fraser real quick, shouldn't we?
Yeah, Fraser, I mean, you all listened to last week's episode. I don't think anything's really changed from that state of affairs, where I think Fraser's trying to go back to the indie drama days, and he's taking lesser leading roles and more like supporting roles.
Yeah.
This is another movie that I would probably akin to The Quiet American or Gods and Monsters, where he's acting alongside a bigger name actor. Although
Keaton's in a down period. This movie is weird. Because I think the appeal to Fraser in this movie is the twist at the end. And I think that's why he's interested in doing this movie.
Yes.
I think that is what appeals to him and gets him locked into this movie.
Yeah, but there's a problem.
Yeah, it takes an hour and 25 minutes of an hour and 30-minute movie to get to the twist.
Yes.
For
us to get that one really juicy bit.
Yeah,
the one juicy
scene.
Yeah.
That almost saves the movie, but...
Almost, but...
If you do that twist 20 minutes earlier, it probably saves the movie.
But then what would the rest of the 20 minutes...
Michael Keaton losing his shit to realize how hard he'd been played.
I guess so.
But yeah, Fraser at this point, it's what we talked about in last week's episode, where his blockbusters are starting to implode. And when it comes to the dramatic work, he's not getting the interesting roles to fall back on.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's not able to, you know, pull a Tom Cruise where he's doing interesting dramatic work and interesting action work at the same time in the 90s and the 2000s.
Yeah.
So if one fails, he falls back on the other.
Yeah.
You know, when one starts flopping, it's the end of the other.
Yeah.
He's not really known as a dramatic actor to most.
Yeah.
In spite of his, you know, valiant efforts.
Right. And so... And to call this movie a drama...
It's listed as a black comedy online.
Which...
But it's not funny. It's not really that funny.
There's
like
either.
A few good jokes... But that's it.
What would you label this movie as?
I don't even know. That's the problem, is I don't know what the... I would label this movie as a non-erotic thriller. Because, you know, there's the erotic thriller genre, which we've...
Yeah.
What was the really hot Brendan movie that we talked about?
Still Breathing?
Still Breathing, where, like, you know, I went horn dog.
Yeah,
Still Breathing was kind of an erotic drama, but you know, when I say erotic thriller, when I talk about erotic thriller, I'm talking like Your Basic Instincts, Fatal Attraction, Decision to Leave.
Yeah,
these movies that are about businessmen or cops, men in suits
falling
in love with a dangerous woman, and that correlating with this conspiracy that they're involved in.
Yeah,
that's what this movie is. But it's a very flaccid erotic thriller. Like
that was good.
Yeah,
I don't know if you intended if that was intentional, but that was really good.
Yeah, it's a flaccid erotic thriller.
Very flaccid erotic thriller. That's really good, Jeff.
No, that's what this movie is.
I like that a lot.
Because the main core of this movie is like the sexual tension between the three main characters.
Yeah.
But like,
but one of them doesn't have any sexual tension.
Yeah, here's the thing. One of them doesn't have any sexual tension. it takes so long to get to the payoff of it.
Yeah.
Like, there's never really any tension.
Right.
Outside of the sexual nature, like, there's never any tension between the characters.
Yeah.
Until the very end. And then number three, it's just not hot.
No, it's not.
Like, this, like...
The sex scenes aren't...
Have you seen Basic Instinct?
Yes.
Okay, like, you watch Basic Instinct, like, aside from that being a really good movie, a very intense thriller...
Yeah.
And that movie's hot. Like, it's compelling to watch because you're like, oh, Michael Douglas and Sharon Stone are attractive people.
Yeah.
And these scenes are very attractively shot and staged and structured.
Yeah.
This is interesting to watch as a movie, but also you're getting pleasure out of it. And I'm not saying that for me, necessarily. I'm saying from a filmmaking standpoint, that is how that thing works.
Well...
Sex in movies has, you know...
Has its selling point.
Yeah, it's a selling point in addition to, like, serving a thematic and story purpose.
Right. Which... I don't want to derail anything, but, like, it opens up to a broader conversation of how much should sex sell.
Yeah.
Because here's the undeniable truth that I think people have to swallow about movies, is that sex does sell.
Yeah.
But here's where the ethics comes into play.
It better be good.
It better be good and non-superlative.
Yeah. Superfluous.
Superfluous, sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah. It better be, like, what you decide to show and do... better be worth it. And I think there are some movies that from an outside perspective could be looked at as being superfluous pornos. Yeah. Like, have you seen there are defenders of, like, Nymphomaniac out there.
A movie I have not seen. But it has the best posters of all time.
Yes, it does. I've seen the posters.
Folks, pause the episode right now. Go to your phone, computer, iPad, whatever you use. Look up Nymphomaniac posters. The Lars von Trier movie. And enjoy. It's the best poster campaign ever put together. Stuart, how does this one make you feel? How does this make you feel? Did it? Okay, yeah.
Yeah. Well.
How does this make you feel?
Stop.
How does that make you feel?
Stop.
Stuart cannot say what I just showed him.
Nope. I can't.
Stuart, how does this one make you feel?
I don't.
How does this one make you feel?
I'm crying. Fucking hell. Why can't I find the name of this movie?
Yeah, the thing about sex in movies is it either has to serve a good thematic purpose or be very cinematic.
Yeah, movies like
it has to be interesting to watch.
Movies like Love, movies like I mean, some people would say Nymphomaniac. I'm kind of different on that movie. But there are movies where the core central theme of it is sex and people's relationship to
each other through sex.
Each other through sex. That, on from an outsider perspective, can be seen as superfluous, but it has deeper meaning behind that. I think, like, The Handmaiden is often quoted with that there's, like, a lot of sex scenes in The Handmaiden, yet it's defended because
that's a defense, because Game of Thrones was a show that got a lot of criticism for its sex scenes.
Mm-hmm.
And watching that show, I, number one, think all the sex scenes, none of them are particularly attractive. Like, it's not like, they don't shoot those sex scenes to be like, well, watch this, ooga ooga.
Yeah.
They shoot them mostly just to be ugly.
Yeah.
But then I think that show is so much a show about the dynamics of power.
Yeah.
And it uses every sex scene as a way of showing dynamics of power. Whether that's in a interpersonal relationship, in a political relationship.
Yeah.
In a interpersonal and political relationship. Or in an animosity driven relationship. But that show, I think, did actually thread the line of having interesting sex scenes.
To even support that point, the because Emilia Clarke was one of the most like outspoken persons on that, because I think it was after season one.
And Emma says no actor should ever be put in a situation where they feel uncomfortable doing a sex scene.
Yeah.
If an actor is uncomfortable doing a sex scene, there should be workarounds.
Yeah.
Or that scene should not be done.
Yeah.
I want to emphasize that point.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
One thing I was going to say is, you know, Emilia Clarke being one of the biggest, like, outspoken of, like, I feel like the filmmakers just want my boobs to be on screen, kind of. And it definitely, from that, I think post season one changed for sure. But I still hold that the best sex scene in Game of Thrones with Emilia Clarke is the one where she, like, she basically is not nude at all in it. It's the one with her and Drago when she kind of takes power over their sex in some way. Because it serves like multiple purposes in that. And like, there's no nudity on her end from that part, but it sells the point across. Yeah.
The arc of Daenerys in that show is from oppressed to oppressor.
Yeah.
Oh, that's her 8-season arc.
Yeah.
Say what you will, whether you like the last season or not, that's the arc that she goes through. She has to start as the most oppressed person ever, to end as the biggest oppressor. That's how that storyline works. We're not here to talk about Game of Thrones.
We're not here to talk about Game of Thrones. We're not even here to talk about sex scenes.
Yeah.
This whole point was to be made.
The whole point was to be made.
Do you like how much we're trying not to talk about this movie?
No, this whole point is to get to that this movie, the sex scenes are really boring to watch.
Yes.
It's like silhouette-y Michael Keaton and, God, what's her name? Amber Valletta, out of focus in a bed.
Yeah.
And all like the date scenes. There's not. Michael Keaton is great. There's not really any chemistry between any of these characters.
No, and I would even say like there's no tension.
Yeah.
So that's the thing. I mean, should we get into the plot?
Yeah, it is one thing I want to say from the opening credits that was interesting is that both Keaton and Fraser are executive producers on this movie.
No shit.
Which, you know, can mean anything in Hollywood. It could just mean that they wanted a cut of the movie.
Maybe they took a pay cut
That was like the deal.
Yeah.
But I did find that interesting that two of them seemingly were compelled to make this movie.
Yeah.
So yeah, we can just dive right into the plot.
So movie starts off with it's like a slowly pixelating screen. Yeah. Like we get dots on a screen that keep forming and appearing to form in the first frame.
The first like 2 minutes are just introducing the setting, like the world of the movie, which is we're just at a sales company.
Yeah.
We never really elaborate on sell. They make machines for businesses. But what those machines do is never explained. We're going to say printers.
Yeah, we said printers, but there's the only thing that like we have to base that off of is they talk, one of their clients is named like Imprint Solutions or something like that.
If this movie is like 60% flaccid erotic thriller, it is 40% drama about the DLX-179 machine. There's a lot of mentions of DLX-179 in this movie.
Yes.
It's this like machine that's going to revolutionize the fucking world.
Yeah, that hasn't come out yet.
Yeah, it has. It's too retro. You wouldn't know about it.
Yeah. So yeah, this movie starts and we get introduced to like the business, the sales business that these folks are in charge of. We should say like we get introduced to like the ensemble of the sales floor first. And the sales floor consists of a few salesmen. First, we should start with the manager, of course, Jeff.
Yes.
Manager, of course, the character name is John Whitman, played by...
Daniel Stern. Daniel Stern is in this movie. It's the first time I've ever seen him in anything that is not Home Alone.
Marv from Home Alone is the sales manager.
I found it really unsettling.
When he started swearing and cussing and smoking.
No, it was just it's impossible to see this man as anything but Marv from Home Alone because I've never seen him in anything else before.
Yeah. But then there are a few other salesmen on the floor. Like we get some actors' names. Some you might recognize. Some you probably won't. Like Neil McDonough is one of the salesmen. Richard Coleman, Alexis Cruz Alvarez, William Ragsdale. Like there's a few different like salesmen. that we get reintroduced to back and forth in the show. So yeah, we have like the, some folks in the sales force that we get introduced to, as well as Daniel Stern as a boss. And yeah, that's when we get the introduction to Michael Keaton.
Yes.
As Ted Riker. Ted Riker.
Riker, yeah.
Ted Riker. Ted Riker, he is the top salesman of their division.
Yes.
Selling what? We still don't know, but yeah, he's their
top. But his whole bit is that he's like a really grumpy divorce guy. That's like his bit.
Yeah.
And he's an asshole to all the clients, but he makes sales. We're simultaneously introduced to the new guy on the block, who's Brendan Fraser, playing Jamie Bashant. He's just Jamie. Yeah. He's like, he came in from Ohio. He was like the star salesman in Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
And now he's been brought in as like a new recruit in this New York-based sales force.
Yeah, they really emphasize that, you know, he's from the Midwest, Ohio.
Yeah.
So he doesn't, you know,
he's really nice. He tries to make friends with all his,
yeah,
his clients.
It's very like, you know, as someone from the Midwest, I find it very rude, the stereotype that all Midwesterners are nice.
Yeah.
No matter how true it may or may not be.
Yeah.
But yeah. And so
they get paired up.
They get paired up. Jamie's Ted's new partner.
It's established that the company is like struggling this quarter. Ted's the only one who's making like real sales.
Mm-hmm.
All these other guys keep failing. This is important. That there's a lot of other guys in the sales company who are like getting fired or dropping out.
Mm-hmm.
One guy got like attacked. One guy just like couldn't make the cut. But there's a lot of people falling out.
Yeah.
And Ted's like their one guy who's like really succeeding still.
Yeah.
And so he and Jamie go out and they attempt to make some sales. Jamie is floundering immediately. Ted's succeeding whenever he steps in.
Mm-hmm.
And they, basically at this point, it's more or less a philosophical debate between the two of them about what makes a good salesman.
Yeah.
Ted's like, it's about making the sale. Nothing else. You don't want to be their friend.
Always be closing.
Yeah. You're not there to be their friend. You're there to make the sale.
Yeah.
You're there to like tell them, hey, fuck you. I don't like you, but you need like
you need
this is
product.
A better deal for you. You need my product.
Yeah.
Whereas Jamie's trying to like, you know, be the traditional salesman and it's not working. Jamie's also, you know, he's in love. He is engaged to this woman, Beliza. Beliza. I barely Beliza'd that she'd fall in love with Brendan Fraser.
Jeff Beliz.
Jeff Beliz. but no, he talks about how much he loves her, and Ted tells him that he doesn't believe in love. This is important. I'm going to keep saying that.
He's the it's the classical marriage is a waste, it'll ruin your life.
Yeah,
because
he is recently divorced, as we said.
Yes.
He's divorced, and he left his old job that we will get to later.
Yeah. So at this point we can kind of run through it pretty quickly. Essentially,
yeah,
they go through many sales tactics that keep failing for Jamie's part.
Yeah.
He hasn't made a sale yet.
And Ted's the only thing keeping him afloat.
Yeah.
Which results in him bringing Ted to his house to meet his wife, Beliza.
Yes.
Played by Amber Valletta.
Yes.
And immediately Ted and Beliza kind of hitting it off.
They're kind of hitting.
There's a little tension at the house.
A little bit.
But Ted's like, nah, I don't believe in love, all that fun stuff.
Yeah.
Then he runs into her at a bookstore.
Yeah. This was a...
Jamie will actually disappear from this movie for like 5 to 10 minutes at a time.
Yeah.
And then we get back to Fraser. He's like, ah!
Yeah. I liked the bookstore scene.
Yeah, that was a good scene.
It was a good scene. It was good dialogue between the two of the actors.
It also has the most subtle fucking like foreshadowing. The wall, like, the aisles that they're in must be, like, foreshadow aisle or something like that. Because, like, they're standing next to these books, and on her coverage, like, there's books, like, called The Villains, Evil Angels, Raging Heart, Meanie.
Yeah.
It's crazy. It's so, like, incredibly obvious.
Yeah.
And
so then I think the turning point of the movie is when we, you know, Jamie and Ted are trying to make this really big sale. And Jamie crashes it.
Yeah.
He just totally fumbles the ball, doesn't make the sale, and he is like depressed. This like it's like, I haven't made a single goddamn sale.
Yeah.
Nothing that I'm doing is working. I keep trying to do what you're telling me to do, but it's just not working. Blah, 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 blah. And Ted makes a suggestion, well, let's go get a drink tonight. So they go to a strip club.
Yeah, classic place to go get a drink.
For businessmen.
Whenever I'm with my coworkers, I'm like, let's go get a drink, and we go to the strip club. Yeah, that's what we do.
All the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All the time. Always.
We always find Bridget.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But Fraser gets really drunk and passes out in like a private room.
Well, he's making out with this one stripper.
Yeah.
And then we cut to back at Fraser's home. Jamie and Belisa's home. Belisa's wearing like this sort of like skimpy lingerie outfit, nighty, and she's prepping like a formal dinner. And then the camera does this really weird, non subtle.
No, I'm listening.
Oh,
I'm listening.
This weird, non subtle like whip pan over. And we see a Ted holding a drunken Jamie.
Yeah.
And he's like, yeah, we got a little drunk at the bar. And so they both carry him to their bed.
Yeah.
They drop him on the bed. He is passed out cold.
They start undressing him.
And then they start undressing Jamie.
And their hands touch.
And their hands touch on his zipper.
Yeah.
Believe it
or
not.
And then the two of them go to Pound Town on each other.
They start making out.
Yeah.
And then they go from making out to making love. Yeah. On the bed
next
to a passed out Jamie.
The camera does move over to Jamie and we see his hand move. And you would think that it's foreshadowing that he knows. It's foreshadowing something else.
Is it?
He's faking.
Oh. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
I
didn't catch that bit.
That he's faking at all.
Yeah. No.
He's pretending to be drunk. Spoiler alert for the ending.
Yeah.
Basically, I mean, like, they just get into a full-blown affair, and that's the next, like, 40 minutes of the movie.
Yep.
It's them in an affair, Jamie losing his shit more and more with Ted.
Yeah, and also while that's happening, because of the affair, Jamie's been having problems with Belisa at home. Belisa wants to postpone the wedding, starting to talk about moving out. Belisa and Ted have been spending more time together, going more dates, things are getting serious. And they at one point have this conversation, pillow talk conversation about Dorian Gray.
Yeah. The photo of Dorian Gray about how, like, you know,
Dorian Gray doesn't have to pay for his sins now, unlike us.
He pays for them later.
Yeah.
Keaton reveals during the same conversation that he's a former teacher.
Yeah.
And after his relationship collapsed, he got out of that game because he was so bitter.
Yeah.
And, like, he couldn't make it work financially and all that fun stuff.
And that's when he went to sales. Yeah.
Yeah. I wrote in my notebook, Keaton or Fraser is playing Limp Dick McGee. He just can't figure things out.
Yeah.
He's just losing shit. All of his like sales are failing. This guy is like almost comically bad.
Almost.
And you later find out why he is almost comically bad. But
yeah,
that's what I'm like, there's no way
this guy is that
a
bad.
Person can be this bad at this.
Right.
And
he not only when we say he starts to lose his shit, we mean visually.
Yes.
He starts to look more disheveled every day. He starts to have like the makeup on his face gets more and more pronounced on like how tired he looks.
Yeah.
He starts to smoke, he starts to cuss more.
Yeah, he's gonna get fired, and Keaton basically bargains for him to get a second chance if he can make a sale.
Yeah.
It's also early in the movie established that Fraser started going to art class, and he has a little notebook that he draws in.
Yeah.
But he gets Fraser a second chance, and he fucks it up, and he gets fired.
Yeah.
And Belisa, you know, talking with Ted is like, he's been kind of crazy recently. Stop taking his antidepressants. And they're like, wait a second, what?
Hey, what's going on?
And that's when you start thinking this movie's going in one direction.
Because then there's a scene where it's like Ted is driving Jamie, and Jamie's talking about how he got fired. He's like, stop by the office. I need to say something to John.
Mm-hmm.
And when he leaves the car, Ted picks up his journal.
Yeah.
And he opens it. And what does he find inside, Jeff?
He's like looking. It's like these sketches of a woman, sketches of plants. And then he gets the next phrase, it's a decapitated head of Belisa.
Yeah.
And then one of him shooting Belisa. Yeah. And all these things say, die, die, die. Like all these grotesque images of like demons and shit. It's like over the top. And I'm like, oh my God, is Fraser about to turn into a serial killer?
Yeah, I was starting to hoot and holler a little
if
bit.
If the last 23 minutes of this movie had been Fraser just like in a bloody rampage spree, I'd be probably really into it.
Yeah, same.
It does not do that.
It doesn't do that. And there's a reason for it.
Yeah.
Which we'll explain.
And so Fraser kind of disappears.
Yes.
Keaton at this point completely falls apart. He kind of flops roles with Fraser from the beginning. He can't make a sale. People start calling him Willie Loman, which is the Death of a Salesman character from the Arthur Miller play.
Yeah.
They start calling him Willie Loman. The company is collapsing without his sales. It's about to go bankrupt. It does go bankrupt and everyone gets fired. The whole company collapses.
Well, and then his thing with Belisa, which was still going on, like they were going back and forth and they're talking about moving in with each other. And then she drops the bomb on him.
Yeah.
That Jamie has to go back to Ohio because he has to be close to family and friends, and I have to go with him because I can't leave him alone.
Yeah.
And so this is Belisa saying goodbye to Ted.
Yeah.
So Ted's heartbroken too.
Yeah.
So then the business goes under. Ted loses his job.
Yes.
And then we cut to an interesting dinner party scene.
Yeah.
With a character that we didn't mention this, but they go to this like conference where one of their main competitors is giving like a speech of some kind. And
Michael Lerner
yeah.
is the actor's name. He is everyone's favorite New Yorker.
Yeah.
Brooklyner. I'm trying to think what people would know. He was nominated for an Academy Award for Barton Fink. Mm-hmm. He plays Jack in that movie. He's an elf as like the head of the publishing company. He plays a lot of heads of companies.
Yeah.
He's like one of those actors who will come and you're like, oh, this is the head of the company.
Yeah.
He's an X-Men Days of Future Past as a senator, apparently. I'm trying to think about what else people might know him from. He's in a lot. I've seen him in a million and a half things. Everyone's seen him in a lot of stuff.
Yeah. And it's a dinner party with that actor, and he's talking to all these different people about, oh, yes, our plan worked. The company went under. Their stock just dropped like 50%. It's all good news. And like, yeah, you know, I always talk to, you know, as I said in like many of my speeches to other companies, you know, the bringing down your competitors has to come. You have to take down the top dogs first or something
yeah.
like that. It makes it an allegory about like, I don't know. It's like something about war. Or it's like an allegory about something.
Yeah.
That he then relates to taking down the top salesman of the company. And then we get intercut flashbacks to, as Jeff had mentioned previously, the different salesmen that have been getting fired or quit or they drop out. And it's all planted threads that they've been affected by one other guy. And one guy says, yeah, I made this one salesman think that he should quit sales and join an art class or a dance lessons and shit. Well, I made my sales guy think that he was depressed or mm-hmm. whatever.
Yeah.
And then the main guy, Michael Lerman, says, and you probably did the best of them all. And it cuts to Brendan Fraser.
Yes.
Who does not look disheveled at all. He is slick. He has a leather jacket yeah. on. He's got like the comb back hair. And he is like fully. And same with Belisa. Is there too, also in like a dinner party cocktail dress. And they're all conniving about, yes, I made my salesman have a conscience.
Yeah.
Because they had this whole plan about how we're going to fake this like relationship and affair.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I'm going to make myself look like I'm losing my shit. So he feels sorry about it.
Yeah.
And then when
it's
all
like,
goes to
the whole thing has been like an 8D chess, like
yeah,
scheme to throw off Keaton's groove so the company would collapse.
Yes.
It's insane.
It is insane.
It's such an insane final twist. It's like at the 11th hour.
Yes.
This movie's like, actually the whole thing has been a multinational corporation conspiracy.
Yes.
But solely to fuck up this guy's sex life.
Yeah.
And the thing is, I haven't really talked about this, but I was, at the beginning of this movie, I was kind of optimistic. about some things.
Yeah.
The thing that was interesting to me about this movie is the idea of Fraser playing a guy who, like, is, you know, was top of his class and is always optimistic and go-getter and whatnot. And the depression that fall comes when it's not panning out the way you wanted it to.
Yeah.
Because this is, like, an interesting point in Fraser's life.
Yeah.
Kind of a hard time for him.
Yeah.
Because going into this movie, he just experienced, you know, sexual harassment.
Yeah.
He'd experienced the birth of two children.
Yeah.
He gets divorced the year after this movie.
Wow.
And so there's, like, I was hoping I was going to see some of him in this. And maybe there is. Instead, it all just kind of gets chalked up in this conspiracy plot line.
Yeah.
So what I was hoping that in this episode I'd be able to talk more about, like, how this probably relates to Fraser's life, but that's not the case.
Mm-hmm.
It's just kind of, it's a nothing burger, but the twist is fun. It's funny, but,
yeah, the ending, like, we figure out the whole plan, because Michael Keaton finds out about this whole thing too. He finds, like, a folder on it at his apartment or whatever that has, like, a psychological evaluation of Ted Riker, and he figures it all out. And so what he does is he packs up his bags and he leaves his apartment and he goes back to that university that he was teaching in. And the last thing we see is we see Michael Keaton in his professor outfit with a satchel going to his classroom or whatever. Mm-hmm. Signaling that he had learned the errors of his ways or something, and that he decided to go back to being a teacher and live, like, a pure life and help others, maybe.
Yeah.
And that, to me, was, like, the most, like, it took, like, a very pessimistic, like, ending of a movie and try to, like, put, like, an optimistic twist on it.
Yeah.
And it takes away the whole, like, what you kind of said. It's like, you thought you were going to be...
Look at that later. I sent you something. Okay. Look at it later.
Like, you thought we were going to be seeing, like, a little bit of Fraser into this. And I thought we were going to, like, you know, get, like, a lesson on, like, you know, the horrors of capitalism, yeah, or things like that. But it all just kind of turns into, like lukewarm milk toast.
Yes.
So I didn't really walk away feeling anything after that.
It's such, like, a non-existent movie, too. Because just to, like, quickly go over the impact of this movie, I'm gonna try and find the box office for this movie.
Yeah,
because it's not on the numbers. Bada-bada-bing. Last time to. This movie has no box office information. Oh, it gets released as a DVD, seemingly. It had a very limited theatrical run, and then it gets released as a DVD in 2007-6.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't make any money. It had a $4 million budget. No one sees it. No one talks about it.
Yeah.
It's sad that all these movies that Brendan's in right now are either flop, big flop, failures that get everyone's attention for how big they failed, or small movies that get no one's attention because no one sees them.
Yeah, which
there's no in between for him right now.
Yeah.
It's like he's constantly trying and pushing through and doing all these things and trying different things and trying to figure out what's going to work, and none of it works.
Yeah.
And it, you know, we're getting very close to his, like, his, I don't want to say blow up point, but his blow up point.
Yeah.
And, you know, the path to hell is paved with good intentions.
Mm-hmm.
Is where we're at.
Yeah.
And that's this movie. That's the last time. It's the last time I'm going to watch this movie.
It's the last time I'm going to watch this movie. It's the last time I'm going to talk about this movie.
Yes. We'll probably talk about it once more at some point.
Probably.
Yeah.
We do the Michael Keaton cast.
We do the Keaton cast. Would we? Is that what we'd call it? The Keaton cast?
Beaten Keaton.
Beaten Keaton. No, absolutely not.
That
absolutely
sounds very, very,
absolutely
very
fucking not.
Yeah, very like problematic. I don't know. I'm sure there's some pun we play on words we can do with Keaton.
Yeah.
Skeeton Keaton.
Skeeton Keaton. But yeah, that's all I got.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else for the last time?
No. That was the last thing I had to say about that. That's all I have to say about that. Yeah, so thank you all for listening.
As always, the last time, that's the last time, yeah. As always, please remember to rate, review, subscribe on whatever platform you're listening on. As a reminder, where we are available on Spotify, Podcast, Google Podcasts, and YouTube. Pop into our Reddit, r/Trevolting, @TrevoltingPod on Twitter or Instagram, TrevoltingPodcast @gmail.com for emails. You find me on Twitter @JeffWSweeney.
You can find me on Instagram @Stuart95.
And as always, special thanks to Rebecca Johnson for our graphic design, Ange Gardner for the social media, and Michael Van Bodegum Smith for the theme music that is now taking you out. Have a great week, folks. See you next week.
Next week for...
Oh, for our episode on The Air I Breathe.
Air I Breathe.
A movie we've all seen.
Yes.
All right, thank you, folks. Have a good one.